Okay, good morning. Welcome to Bio 231, August 31st. It's a Monday, and I hear a buzz in the room, so you guys are good. You're meeting each other, talking to each other. I think that's helpful for the next test, or for any test in here, practicum or lecture exam. So that's fantastic. Get to know some people. Maybe if you can get together and study, that would be good, but don't horse around too much if you're going to get together and study. And let's see, there we go. All right, let's take a quick look at the schedule. And today's the 31st, indeed. We're going to get into the tissues chapter today. We only have a short topic left to do in cells. And as a matter of fact, that's all we're going to talk about this week is tissues. So we actually might get into integument this week as well, which is okay if I'm a little bit ahead of schedule, because take a look at this. On Wednesday, September 16th, that is your first exam. And on Monday, right before that Wednesday, is your last lecture on bones. That's a new chapter, right? So don't wait until after lecture to start studying bones, that bone chapter, because the exam is going to be like the day after, right? So by this week, by September 14th, make sure that you have all your exam study guides printed out. You know what exam figures are going to be on that exam. Maybe work the end of chapter questions so that you're really prepared for that test on the 16th. So before that week, right, so before the 14th, which is a Monday, make sure you know what the scope of what everything is that you have to learn so you don't run out of time, right? Make sure you don't run out of time with that. All right, so chapters 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6, we're skipping number 3. The week after that is your first lab practicum. Fortunately, next Monday, the 7th, is Labor Day. Don't come to school on Labor Day. Right? That is, the campus is going to be closed. So that gives you another little day to study. All right, so that's the schedule. Anybody have a question regarding the schedule at all? Pretty straightforward. It's right there for you. All right, we were talking last time. Let's just go over a couple things of what we were talking about last time. We look at a cell, and what is a cell? What's a good way to think of a cell? Yeah, it's a building block of life, right? Structural and functional unit of life. It's the organizational unit of life. If something is made out of cells, it's possible that it's alive, but if it's not made of cells, you can tell me definitely it is not alive, right? And in order to be a cell, you got to have plasma membrane, you got to have genetic material that is passed on, information is passed on from generation to generation, and then it also has to have cytoplasm. Those three things: cell membrane, cytoplasm, and genetic material. And our cells have all of that, kind of in a special arrangement, because where is our genetic material located? Inside the nucleus, right? So we looked at some other organelles. We looked at a nucleus and mitochondria, Golgi body, and as a matter of fact, you should have in your memory just a bullet point of what each of these organelles accomplishes for our cells. Like Golgi body, what's the job of Golgi body? Package and modification. That's right. What about rough ER?
Protein synthesis.
Smooth ER? Lipid synthesis. And one other important thing that's not made a big deal of, but it is a really big deal. It stores calcium for us. That's right. That's important. Okay, so all the organelles, you should kind of know that stuff for. Okay, let me ask you, what about mitochondria? What does it do? Okay, it makes a form of energy inside our cells that's readily available by almost every process, and that's called ATP. So mitochondria make a chemical called ATP. That is an important energy source for almost everything in our body. Right, well, I want to give you a feeling for how important ATP is. And mitochondria need oxygen to make ATP. And if we turn off that oxygen supply to mitochondria, I want you to have a sense of how long that mitochondria can function. And in particular, there's an easy way to think about that. We have mitochondria in our brain making ATP so we can maintain consciousness. Right, so that our neurons in our brain can send electrical impulses all over, we can perceive our environment, make decisions, and all that kind of stuff. When we turn off oxygen going to the brain, I want you to have a sense of how long can your brain function. So So when does oxygen get turned off to your brain? And that is when your heart stops beating. So you can imagine that's not a good scenario, right? So when your heart stops beating, how long is it before you run out of so much ATP that you lose consciousness? When do you lose consciousness? When your heart stops beating? It's just a matter of seconds. It's between 2 and 3 seconds. 2 and 3 seconds. So does that strike you as a really short period of time? That is a really short period of time for me. All right. And if that oxygen doesn't get restored to the brain is eventually going to die because it has completely run out of energy. So if the heart stops in 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness. When does the brain actually die because it runs out of ATP? 2 to 3 minutes. That's all that person has. Right? If you take a CPR class, I think you kind of go over that idea. So 2 to 3 minutes and your brain runs out of ATP and it dies. And when your person's brain dies, what does that mean? Can we give it like an electrical shock or do anything, slap them? Once something's dead, it's dead. Can't come back to life, right? 2 to 3 minutes for the brain. It's a really fast period of time. So that's how important ATP is. There are some processes that require ATP to move material either into or out of a cell. If material is going to move in and out of a cell and it requires energy, what kind of process is that called? Remember, there are two kinds, two general kinds. And the one that requires energy is called active transport. The one that doesn't require energy is called passive transport. Right. Okay. So how can a compound move passively? How can a compound move passively? Whether it's in a cell or in a living organism or even in this room, how can a particle move from one area to another passively without any energy? And that is called diffusion. That's right. So a molecule will move from high concentration to low concentration, just down the concentration gradient. If I open up a perfume bottle in the front of the class over here on my left-hand side, people on the right-hand side won't smell it, but after a little while, that molecule is going to diffuse, and even people on that side of the class are going to be able to smell it. And even up in the back of the room, right? It's going to move by diffusion. Special case of diffusion, all right, is osmosis. It's got three components to it. Does anybody remember what the three components to osmosis or the three criteria in order for it to be osmosis? What are the three things that have to happen for it to be osmosis? Is it active or passive? It's passive. So how are things going to move? From high to low. That's number one. What is the molecule that's moving? It's water in us, which is the solvent, right? And what's the last criteria? How does water have to diffuse? It's got to diffuse through a membrane. And a special membrane called semi-permeable or selectively permeable. All right, so that's osmosis. Diffusion through a selectively permeable membrane. And it's got to be water only. No other kind of particles like salt particles or sugars or anything like that. Only the water molecule. All right, active transport, right, requires ATP. When there's energy in chemical bonds that make adenosine triphosphate. If a phosphate atom is hydrolyzed or taken off of ATP, you end up with adenosine diphosphate, right? That means two, and then an inorganic phosphate all by itself. But don't forget about that energy that was in that chemical bond that is released. And that energy can be used for active transport processes or other kinds of active mechanisms in your body, like muscle contraction, for instance, would be a really good example. All right, here are some macromolecular kinds of transport, which require ATP because they're active. Phagocytosis. What's a good way to think of phagocytosis? Cell-eating particles. Pinocytosis is cell-drinking. And exocytosis is like secretion, when the cell is exuding something from inside of itself, from inside to outside. And again, that's active. And all of these processes have to do with vesicles, the forming of vesicles and the moving around of vesicles inside the cell. Okay. Here is the last topic, and that is protein synthesis. Okay, and I would guess almost everybody knows what the building block of a protein is. It's a good idea for you to look at things in this class in terms of building blocks. And what is the building block of a protein? Yeah, and when somebody tells you, you're going to, oh yeah, I knew that. It's amino acid. It's a small little molecule. When you make a protein, you just take various amino acids and put them together in a big, long sequence or a chain. Then it becomes a protein. All right, so let me tell you a little bit about how that's done, but you could tell me where that's done. What organelle is necessary for protein synthesis? Ribosome. I did hear ribosome. Fantastic. Exactly right. All right, and there's another organelle that has ribosome, so that organelle has the ability to make a protein. What organelle, what membrane system has ribosomes attached to it so that it can make a protein? The rough ER. The rough part of rough ER contains ribosomes. You also have free ribosomes out in the cytosol. They can make proteins as well. All right, let's see how this goes. All right, so you have a central repository of information on how to make proteins. And that information is located in DNA. DNA is the molecule that makes up chromosomes. That's the molecule that can be replicated and it can be transferred to the next generation, and the information is not lost. This scheme that I'm going to talk about is called the central dogma of biology. And a dogma is just a way of thinking that you should never question, right? Never ever question, just believe it and live your whole life by it. And, of course, if you're a scientist, you can never accept anything to be 100% true, right? But nonetheless, we talk about the central dogma in biology, and then later on as we study a little bit more, maybe next year, year after, you'll learn some other ways to think about protein synthesis, right? But for right now, this is what you should just memorize, all right? So we have information in our chromosomes that are made up of DNA. That information is converted into another form of information that we call RNA. And notice these two terms are pretty similar, right? And then RNA, the information in RNA, is converted into a protein. And that information goes from DNA to RNA to protein. Can that information ever go back? Can information in a protein change somebody's RNA? And can that RNA change somebody's DNA? I see some arrows. Which way are the arrows pointing? In one direction or both directions? One direction. That means information can flow in one direction only, not backwards. Right? So when you sit down and have a chicken dinner tonight, which is a bunch of protein, you don't have to worry about waking up in the morning with a beak and feathers, because that protein can't change your DNA or that information inside of a nucleus. Right? You're going to be you no matter what. All right. And how many step process is it to make a protein from DNA? And what you see right here is how many arrows do you see? There, you see two arrows, so there are two steps to make a protein. That's another thing that this little illustration tells you. All right, so you should know information flows from left to right, and in just these steps, DNA to RNA, RNA to protein, and it's a one-way direction, then we're going to fill in some of the other details. All right, so information in DNA always flows from DNA into proteins, never the reverse. And I think everybody's happy with that. This first arrow, okay, is the first step. We call that transcription. When information in DNA is converted into RNA, we call that transcription. Who's got a good sense of what transcription refers to? What is transcription? Oh, you'll like this because it's really simple. Transcription is making a photocopy of something, right? Like an exact duplicate. If you go to another college or apply for a job, those people might ask for a transcript. And what is a transcript? That transcript is made by a process of transcription. What is a transcript for you guys and for me? It's a photocopy of all your grades that you've taken here at Cypress College or other colleges, right? So transcription is just a photocopy. So RNA pretty much is just a photocopy of DNA. The basic building block of DNA is a nucleic acid. The building block of RNA is a nucleic acid or a nucleotide. You don't have to know this from the class, but the language of DNA and the language of RNA is exactly the same. It's just a little bit different. It's not very different at all. So RNA is really just a photocopy of DNA. That's why we call that process transcription. And where is DNA located? Does anybody know where your DNA is located? Okay. Mitochondria does have some DNA. Okay, and that determines the structure of mitochondria, but not the overall structure of you. What contains the information to build you in particular and not mitochondria necessary? Yeah, in the nucleus. The nucleus contains a genetic material that defines our shape, and that's really nice advanced concept if you know mitochondria have their own DNA. That's really good, right? Because that mitochondria really is like an independent organism living inside our cells making ATP. But the major repository for information inside our cells is in the nucleus. And in the nucleus, DNA is converted into RNA. It's just another copy is made inside the nucleus. So where does transcription take place? It always takes place in the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm. The cytoplasm is kind of a dangerous place to be. There are all kinds of chemicals running around. If you have DNA in the nucleus, it could be broken down or modified somehow, changed, or lost. And if that DNA is lost, then the cell is going to die. So it's got to be inside the nucleus where it's protected. If that information wants to leave the nucleus, it's converted into RNA, then RNA leaves the nucleus. And if that RNA is lost or damaged, it's no big deal, because what can the cell do? Go back to the nucleus, make some more RNA, and put it in the cytoplasm. And if that gets damaged, no problem. Back to the nucleus, make some more RNA, put it in the cytoplasm. Right? All right, so that's the beauty of RNA. Almost the same exact molecule as DNA. That's why we call this a photocopy of DNA, or the process is transcription. When DNA is transcribed, it makes three kinds of RNA. The first one we're going to look at is ribosomal RNA, little r, capital N, capital A. These make up ribosomes. And a ribosome you should think of as the workbench where a protein is going to be made. That's the physical workbench where amino acids are joined together. Transfer RNA is like a taxi RNA. Transfer RNAs are wandering around the cell. They grab an amino acid and they bring it to the workbench. So transfer RNA grabs an amino acid and brings it to the workbench. And what's a better way to say workbench for protein synthesis? The scientific way is ribosome. So the transfer RNA grabs an amino acid, brings it to a ribosome so that amino acid, or the building block of a protein, can actually be used to make a protein. Right, so you could say taxi RNA if you wanted to, but don't tell anybody in the world I told you to say taxi RNA for tRNA. But it is, right? Amino acids just hop a ride on tRNA to bring it to a ribosome. The last one right here, messenger RNA. Okay. Well, a protein, tell me again, once again, what's the building block of a protein? Amino acids, right? There are 20 different kinds of amino acids, and in order to make a protein just the right way, then those 20 amino acids have to be joined together in just the perfect way to make that protein, right? Just sort of like a word. If you want to spell the word, what word do you want to spell? How about biology, right? You know all the letters. Right? And if you spell biology B-A-C-T-A-G-Y, does that spell biology? No. Wrong letters, wrong sequence, it doesn't have the meaning of biology. So if you change the spelling of a word, you change its meaning. If you change the sequence of amino acids in a protein, you change what that protein does. So the protein has to have the correct spelling or the correct amino acids in the correct location. And the messenger RNA tells the ribosome what the correct spelling is of that particular protein. That's like the dictionary on how to put these different amino acids together in just the right way so that protein has the right shape. And if a protein has the right shape, guess what also it has? The right function. Yeah. And if it has the wrong shape, it has the wrong function or no function whatsoever. Right? And what determines the function of a protein is how it's spelled out, and the messenger RNA tells the ribosome how to put amino acids together so it has the right shape and the right function. All right, so what's the workbench for protein synthesis? Ribosomal RNA. What's the dictionary for protein synthesis? Messenger RNA. And what brings amino acids to a ribosome so they can be put in to make a protein?
TRNA.
Yeah, that's the transfer RNA. Okay? So that's how I think of it. Might seem pretty simple, but I like thinking about it like that. All right. So, and that, where does this process of making RNA take place? In the nucleus, what's it called? Transcription, because it's basically a photocopy of the DNA inside the nucleus. All right. Well, so the first step makes RNA. RNA is not a protein, so we need the second step. Here's the second step. It's called translation. Translation is when you take information in RNA and convert it into information in a protein. And so RNA, the building block of RNA is a nucleic acid. And what's the building block of protein once again? Oh, amino acid. All right, so here we have translation going from a language of nucleic acid to a language of amino acid. What do you call that process when you have information in one language converted into another, but you don't change the information, you just change the language? Yeah, that's translation, right? So that's like going from Farsi to Spanish, right? Spanish to Arabic, or Mandarin to English. Don't lose the information. Information has to be exactly the same, but a different language nonetheless. And that's because the language of RNA is different than the language of protein. This does not happen in the nucleus. It occurs in the cytoplasm, never in the nucleoplasm, never inside the nucleus, because once RNA is made, it leaves the nucleus and it goes into the cytoplasm for this second step. And you could probably even tell me the name of the organelle responsible for making proteins that get packaged into a vesicle, and maybe it leaves the cell through that secretory pathway. It starts in rough ER, goes into the Golgi apparatus, then a vesicle, and then either stuck inside the cell or it gets kicked out by a process. How does that vesicle release its contents to the outside world? Exocytosis. Yeah, that's what we call exocytosis. All right, so who's got a question about protein synthesis? You're going to have to look at that a couple days. Ask me some questions. It maybe has a lot of little details, but I'm sure everybody can get a good hang for what's going on, especially if you listen to the lecture again. And I have the lectures online, but I haven't activated the page yet, but I will do that this week. Okay. All right, so how many step process is protein synthesis? Two. And the first step is? Transcription, where does that take place? Nucleus. Second step is translation, where does that happen? And can it go backwards? No, can't go backwards, right? That's good. So that's it for this chapter. I have mitosis right here, but we covered mitosis in lab pretty well. All right, just remember, what's the difference between these daughter cells? Absolutely nothing. Difference between daughter cell and a parent cell? Absolutely nothing. Right, same number of chromosomes, same everything about them. Here are the steps of mitosis. What else is important for mitosis? Maybe you should know, what is the reason for mitosis? What's the reason for mitosis? Two things. Oh yeah, I like that. Replace old and damaged cells, maybe dead ones. You want to replace them. And growth, to get big. Yeah, that's the most important things. Okay. So mitosis, where do we have here? Mitosis is the separation of genetic material into two daughter cells. And cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells. And cytokinesis is going to take place during telophase for the purposes of this class. Okay, that's when the cells pinch apart, right, telophase. Okay, who's got a question? Anybody got a question? How fast did I go over protein synthesis? Like too fast or kind of followed with what I was saying? Okay. No questions so far? All right, look that over. Just look at this nice graphic right here. It's a one-way street. And you know where it stops and where it ends. All right, the next chapter, nice, is going to be histology, or the study of tissues. All right, so I'm working both sides of the projector, two projectors right now. And so let's think. Cytology is the study of cells. And what's the building block of a cell? What's the building block of a cell? I heard it. Organelles. Somebody said organelles over here? If you said organelles in your mind, that's great. You put a bunch of organelles together, you get a cell. Okay? And if you put a bunch of cells together, what do you get? A tissue. That's what we're going to study in this chapter. All right, so tissue is a group of cells, but there's also something special too that we didn't mention yet. Those cells have to have the same or similar shape to them. To make a tissue, all the cells are going to have the same shape. That also means all the cells have the same, if they have the same shape, they have the same function. Yeah, not just the overall shape of the cell, but all the molecules inside have the same shape, right? Then they have the same function. So a nice definition of a tissue is a group of cells with a similar shape, all performing the same function. And that's sort of like I said, kind of an oxymoron because it means the same thing. Okay, so study of tissue structure and function. Well, you might think that you're a pretty complicated body, and you sort of are, but you only have four tissues that make up your whole body. That's not very many tissues. You point to some part of your body, I could tell you which four, one of the four it is. That's a pretty easy job to do, and now you're going to learn how to do it as well. Okay. Here are the four types. You got epithelium, connective, muscle, and nervous tissue. Right? Epithelium is a kind of tissue that covers a surface or lines a cavity inside your body. So what's the organ system that covers your body? The organ system is called the? Yeah, you don't know what it is unless you studied anatomy sometime. It's a weird word. It's called the integumentary system, right? Your skin is your integument. And guess what kind of tissue makes the outermost covering? It is an epithelium, because an epithelium covers a surface, and the surface of your body is a surface. All right, so that's what we're going to start with, epithelium. Here are some characteristics of epithelium. We said covers the surface of the body, like your skin, can also line cavities inside your body, like the lining of your gastrointestinal tract, the inside lining of blood vessels, that's epithelium as well. Most glands are made out of epithelium. We're going to see some glands when we look at skin. That's going to be easy to see. When we look at epithelium, the cells that make an epithelium are closely packed together. There's no space between the cells. They're pretty much just glued together, so we say it's most mainly of cells. There is a free surface, or what we call apical surface, where you find the cavity, or like the outside world, if it's your skin. And at the very base of that layer, there's a membrane called the basement membrane, so we call that the basal surface. And here's something really strange. Never contains blood vessels. Right? So it contains nerves. Maybe you've gotten a paper cut at some point in your life. Ever get a paper cut? Anybody ever get a paper cut? The hair on my back is kind of standing up because, it stings really bad. You get a paper cut, right? And then if you're bleeding really bad, just pressure will stop that bleeding. So you put your other finger over that paper cut so it doesn't, blood all over the floor because it felt really, really bad. Felt like you really damaged your finger. And then you move your finger away and you look and there's not even a drop of blood there. Okay? And that's because that paper cut has cut into the epithelium but not deep enough to where it even found a blood vessel. But it did, right, damage those nerves and it hurt like hell. But no blood. So epithelium never contains blood vessels. Let's look at the slide on the right. Here we have kind of a nice example of how we want to start thinking about epithelium. Right, so here is that free space with nothing above it. Right, this could be the inside of the tube of your digestive tract, for instance. Right here, the free space. So this surface is what we call the apical surface. On the other side of the cell, this is the deep part. So here is the basement membrane. So this is what we call the basal surface. And if we look at this, so here's one cell. If we look at the basal surface and compare it to the apical surface, do they look the same? I see a bunch of, right, like microvilli and cilia on the apical surface, none on the basal surface. So what could you tell me about the function of the basal surface and apical surface? Has different shape. It can have different functions, right? So this one over here is for absorption. This one here is for motility. Not so for this basement membrane or this basal surface, right? So apical could be different than basal, and that's just because of the kinds of proteins that can be put into that membrane. Remember the fluid mosaic model of how to think of a membrane? Okay. And this basement membrane helps connect the epithelium to underlying structures. And this can be connective tissue, and in that connective tissue, you can have blood vessels and nerves, and maybe even some muscles in here as well. All right, so the important thing is when we have an epithelium, we got a top surface. What do we call the top surface? Apical, and the bottom surface we call basal, and right at that basal surface, there's usually a nice, smooth membrane, right like this, that I see. All right, so I think that's the important thing about how generally to think about an epithelium. We classify an epithelium in two different ways. Number one, by layers, and number two, by the shape of cells. And both of those have to do with structure. If I look at this top epithelium in this example, I see the basement membrane right through here. So here's the basal surface. Here's the apical surface with this free space above it. Right. And if we go from the basal surface to this free space, how many cells do we have to cross to get from one area to the other? One, two, many? I just see one, right? And so we call that a simple epithelium if there is just one layer of cells from basal surface to apical surface. What about the case on the bottom? Here is the basal surface. Here's the apical. How many cells do we have to go through to get from the basement membrane to the apical surface? One or many? Those are your choices. You don't even have to count them out. One or many? Many, yeah. And if the layers are many, then we call that stratified. So epithelia are pretty easy in terms of layers. It's either simple or stratified. And you don't have to count the layers. All right, that's one way. The other way is by the shape of cells that make up the epithelium. And the three general shapes of cells is that it can be flat, like a fried egg, right? Here's a little yolk in the egg. Here's the egg white, turned white. Just flat cell. And we call that squamous. Squamous means flat. Our skull has a flat part, kind of running into our ears right here. Guess what region that's called on your skull? That's the squamous region right there. So squamous means flat. If you have a cell that's not flat, all right, if its width is about is the same length as it is tall, as it is deep, right, then this looks more like a cube. And so we call that a cuboidal type cell. And notice it's not exactly square like this over here, but it's not very tall, certainly not flat, so this is a cuboidal cell. And then the third case, if it turns into be a really tall cell, right, so that the height is a lot more than the width or the depth, then this is what we call columnar. And if we just know those designations, we can talk about pretty much any kind of epithelium in the body. Number one, by layers, and number two, by the shape of the cells. So let me go back one slide. Back one slide. Okay. How would we classify the epithelium in this bottom row of cells? First it is stratified. Okay, now here's the trick. When we name an epithelium by the shape of the cells, we look at the apical surface, not the basal surface. So you might be misled because these cells here look cuboidal, but this is not a stratified cuboidal epithelium. Look at the shape of the cells on the apical surface. These are squamous. So this epithelium right here is stratified squamous epithelium because these cells are flat on the apical surface. Right, so now you know how to read these different kinds of epithelia. Okay. Here is a pretty good slide. You're going to look at some slides that look like this in lab. And, oh, here's a nice marker right here. Okay. Let's take a look at this marker for just a second. Turn this light on for a second. Nice. Okay. So you could consider this marker a tube. Just think that it goes for a long distance, right? We're just looking at a little piece of it. And let's cut this tube in half with a nice transverse section, just like this. All right, just exactly perpendicular to it. Take the pieces apart and look into that tube. What is that tube going to look like if we look into it? It's going to look like a... What does that look like? It's going to look like a circle, right? It's going to look like a circle. If we cut it just like that, it's going to look like a circle. So if we take a tissue and cut it and we see something that looks like a circle, like right here and right here, what do we know? That it is a tube that's going in and out of the plane that we're looking at. It's a tube. If we have that tube, and instead of cutting it on a transverse section, if we cut it on a longitudinal section, then it's going to just look like two rows of cells with a space between them, right? If we cut this marker open, you see this wall here and this wall here, and then the space between them. And that's what I see right here, right? I see kind of a tube. So the orientation of this tube is more like this. The orientation of this tube is more like that. So this one is going within the plane, this one is going right through the plane of how this particular tissue was cut. And some of them might look a little oval, like this one looks a little oval, because if you take a nice straight tube like this, right, and cut it on an angle and look at it, then it's going to look like an oval. Right? And the more you turn it like that, the more it's going to look straight, the more you turn it like that, the more it's going to look like a circle. All right, so let's analyze this slide a little bit more. The first thing that I look for is this nice line. See this nice dark line right through here? It's pretty thin. You see a line right here? Go ahead, tell me if you see that line. Yeah. See that line? So that's separating this from this compartment down over here. They look different. That is the basement membrane. Above that is going to be an epithelium. So look what I have right here. What is this right here? Basement membrane. What do I have right here? Basement membrane. All right, so here's the basement membrane. Here is some free space with nothing in it. So this is the apical surface of the epithelium. So if you count the number of cells from the basement membrane to the apical surface, how many cells are we going through to get from one place to another? I just see one. I see the nucleus, and then I see some cytoplasm around it, but for sure, only one cell. So by number of layers, what would you call this epithelium? Yeah, simple. This is a simple epithelium, right? And if I look at this cell right here, the height is about the same length as the width. And if we were to look at the whole cell, the depth would be the same. So the shape of this cell is, you see, cuboidal. Okay, it's not circular. For instance, if it was going to be squamous, right? This is a nice cuboidal cell. So to classify this epithelium, you'd use both the shape and layers. So it is a simple cuboidal epithelium. All right, now what do you see? You see some cubes over here? Cube, 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 cube. Just a single layer. The center part of a tube that's carrying, well, it could be urine if it's a ureter, could be saliva if it's a duct of a salivary gland, could be digesting material if it's part of your digestive tract. But anyway, the inside part of the tube, right, is what we call the lumen, L-U-M-E-N. The lumen of a tube carries some kind of material from one place to another. And the lumen of a blood vessel, what does the lumen of a blood vessel carry? What is the lumen of a blood vessel? Can you picture where the lumen of the blood vessel is? It's the innermost part of the blood vessel. And it's carrying blood. All right, blood flows through the lumen of a blood vessel. All right, so here is a nice, simple cuboidal epithelium. When you look at a basement membrane, it should be nice and smooth and continuous like this. Do you see any jagged or broken pieces of a basement membrane anywhere on here? I don't. It's always nice and smooth and continuous. Even over here, smooth and continuous. That means that this is a nice, healthy tissue. If this basement membrane is broken and some of these cells are starting to punch out and grow in different areas, right, that would be bad. That could be an indication of cancer or some other kind of disease taking place, right? So this basement membrane, you're going to notice, right, is on most of the slides that we look at in terms of epithelium, because it's so important. Your eye should just automatically focus on that, find the apical surface, and then you can tell the number of layers. So here's a tube, here's a tube, here's a tube, here's a tube down over here, and all of this stuff between the tubes, right, is a different kind of tissue. It's not epithelium. This is what's this is what is connecting the tubes together so they don't move around. So hence we call this a connective tissue. See, this lead line goes all the way over to right here. That's a connective tissue. We're not going to talk too much about that in this when we look at epithelia. Another thing to look at. Look at this cell. We were looking at this one earlier. Here is a neighboring cell. Right, here's a cell membrane. Here's a cell membrane. So here's another neighboring cell. Are there spaces between the cells that make up this tube? Is there a space between this cell and this one? No. All right, the cells of epithelia are connected together. They're tightly packed closely together. There's no space between them. All right, so that's another important characteristic of epithelium. I'm going to mention that a couple more times. So we got simple cuboidal epithelium. Let's look at this slide right here. A little bit different magnification. Oh, look at this, 1,150 times. We can't do that in lab. But here is that line, nice smooth line. I see one up over here. That is the basement membrane. Here's that free space with nothing in it. So this surface right here is the apical surface. How many cells do you count when going from the basement membrane to the apical surface? I see one, so by layers, this is a simple epithelium, and by the shape of the cell, it should be pretty easy to see it is columnar, right? Because it's really a lot taller than it is wide, right? So here is a simple columnar epithelium, and what is this space right here that is on the inside of the tube? That's the lumen of this tube. And which way is this tube oriented? Is it moving in and out of the plane like I have the magic marker right now, or is it more like this, going from right to left? That's more like going from right to left, and we cut this tube, cut that tube open. Oh, I'm glad I didn't hit somebody. Right, we cut that tube open, you're going to see the center channel right there filled with stuff. All right, so who does not see a simple columnar arrangement right here? You might not believe it's an epithelium yet, but you see simple, one layer, and columnar cells? Yeah, I hope so. Okay, now what about these cells? Are there spaces between them? Absolutely not. No cells between them. Next slide. Okay, look, this is a really interesting tissue. Here is the basement membrane. It goes around like this. Here is that free space right here. So this is the apical surface. And here's the basal surface. And depending on where you look, okay, you might see one cell that goes all the way down to the basement membrane. Other locations, you might see two or three cells before you get to the apical surface. So sometimes we don't know what to classify this as, so we say pseudostratified. But we can name it in terms of shape. Where should we look for the shape of the cell in order to name it, give this epithelium, okay, its shape name? Apical surface, what are the shape of these cells here? Yeah, they're columnar. That should be pretty easy to see, right? So this is a pseudostratified columnar epithelium, and these things right here are really special. These things are sweet. These are sweeping little extensions of the cell. They're short. And what kind of organelles did you learn for motility? Okay, you learned about flagella. So a human cell could have one flagella that's really long, or they can have a bunch of these shorter ones, and these are called cilia. Right? So this is a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. And one last thing before I talk about everything, I see another special shaped cell right here. This material inside the cell is filled with mucus. And mucus doesn't pick up any stain when we stain these cells, so it just looks like a bright spot underneath the microscope because there's no stain in this area. This is, and it reminds somebody of a wine glass, so they call this a goblet cell. And a goblet cell's job is to synthesize mucus and secrete that mucus onto this apical surface where all these cilia are located. right? And you kind of know mucus is kind of slippery, but it's also kind of sticky. So these cells right here line your windpipe. The nice name for your windpipe is trachea. When we breathe in all kinds of stuff, dust particles and bacteria and viruses that we don't want in our lungs. They get trapped in the mucus secreted by the goblet cell, and then the cilia sweep it. Okay, where do they sweep all that material? Down into your lungs or up into your mouth? Up into your mouth, that's right. And then when it's in your mouth, what do? Yeah, then you swallow it down to get it out of your lungs. You don't want it in your lungs. So this is a pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelium. Really pretty to look at. And here you find it in the trachea as one example. Here you can see a cell that goes all the way from apical surface to the basement membrane. So pseudostratified. All right. Something here looks a little bit more complicated. Here is the basement membrane. Kind of wanders around. So going from the basement membrane to the apical surface, we know this is the apical surface because here's that free space with nothing in it. How many layers do you see? Many. So it is stratified. What are the shape of the cells in this apical surface? Yeah, so it's a stratified squamous epithelium. And for instance, this is the kind of epithelium that lines your oral cavity, and you're already familiar with these, right? Because you sampled some of these. These are buccal cells or cheek cells. And this kind of epithelium is designed to wear off, rub off from your body, but that's okay because all these cells over here replace the ones that fall off. So when you took a sample with a toothpick, you didn't have to worry about putting a hole in your cheek or anything, right? Because those cells regenerate. So this layer here is the one that is growing. So what process is taking place in this layer that is growing? Mitosis, right? Because that's the purpose of mitosis, to replace those cells that are rubbing off on the inside of your mouth and even on your skin. Your skin looks a lot like this too. All right. So now when you look at this thing that probably was pretty intimidating, hard to analyze, can you see that this is a stratified squamous epithelium once you look at it? Shouldn't be too bad. Okay. All right, another kind. Here's a tube. Here's the basement membrane right through here. And here's the apical surface, here's that free space, and this is from a salivary gland, so saliva is running through this tube. And how many layers do you see? Basement membrane, apical surface, I see one, two. So if it's two, we call it a stratified. Yeah. And what is the shape of all of these cells right here? Cuboidal. So this is a stratified cuboidal epithelium, connective tissue down below it. There's that basement membrane. And what do we call that center area of a tube that's carrying something from one place to another? The lumen. And this is a salivary duct, and here's the lumen of that particular duct, right? So that's what lumen means. All right. What about this one right here? This is a good example of a connection between your urinary bladder and the outside world. That would be a urethra. This one happens to be in a male. Right, that should be pretty obvious. Here's that basement membrane, connective tissue down below it. Apical surface, this is where urine would be traveling through the lumen of this particular tube. How many cell layers do you see? Basement membrane to apical surface. Many. So it's stratified. What's the shape of these cells right here? Columnar. So here's a stratified columnar epithelium. This one is not designed to rub off. All right. Connective tissue. Yeah, so on a practicum, remember, I'm going to use the pictures that are in your textbook, so I might ask you, what's the name of this tissue? You would analyze it and say, well, this is a stratified columnar epithelium. All these cells are tightly, closely packed together. It's got to be an epithelium of some kind. Nice columnar cells. Right. Also, I might erase this thing over here and put a number instead of basement membrane, and you would follow that lead line to this area. And the question would be, what is this thing? And then you would say, well, that's the basement membrane, right? You would just write down on your answer sheet just this term right here. Yeah.
Are we also going to need to know locations?
No, you don't have to know locations. You'll learn that as we go through the whole class. Okay. Now, since I have JPEGs of all of these illustrations in your textbook, I think I told everybody, I just emailed Sam's Club all of those JPEGs and they made a photograph out of it. So at least these are in color. Right, so they're not in grayscale or black and white like your lecture exam is going to be. But the ones on the practicum are going to have these nice colors associated with them.
What's the tabby on the connective?
It's like right over here. That could be artifact of preparation. Okay, it could be a vein. I don't see a vein structure right there. It could be an artery. I don't see a structure of an artery right there. So I have a tendency to say that's just artifact of preparation. Yeah, where some cells pulled apart.
Because when you'd be able to say like ostracens, that would be leaving out something. And
oh, this, yeah, if this was a tube, for instance, if this is, so here, let's take a look. Let's take a look at this apical surface. So here is a tube that's going from right to left. Right, here's that free space that's going from right to left. Here's something that looks a whole lot more circular. So here's a tube that would be going in and out of the plane. Right, so blood vessels would be able to do that very easily. Yeah. But that looks more like an artifact to me, here and here. Yeah. Okay. Here is kind of a strange one. But I see something that you should be able to identify. Do you see this as being a separation between what's above it and what's below it? See, that is a nice line of demarcation. That is the basement membrane of this epithelium. Here's that free space. So this is the apical surface, here's the basal surface, and this is kind of a strange epithelium because these cells in the apical surface don't look columnar and they don't look cuboidal and they're kind of puffy, they're way too thick to be squamous, right? And so we don't classify this one by its shape. These are special cells that can be very short in length and tall, or they can be very long and thin. And they can change shape. This is what we call a transitional epithelium, and it is a shape-shifting kind of epithelium. There is an organ in your body that changes shape all day long. It gets really big and then it shrinks down, and then it gets big again and then it shrinks down. And I see it right here, the urinary bladder. And what's stored in the urinary bladder? Yeah, urine from the kidneys. So here are kidneys that are producing urine. And in order for a kidney to stay alive, it has to produce urine. It can never take a break. If it takes a break, then it's dead or dying. So these things are producing urine all the time. You are not urinating all the time, right? That urine is being collected in the urinary bladder until there is a convenient or proper time to void, right? And so when the kidneys are producing urine, you're not voiding, the urinary bladder expands. And when you void, the urinary bladder contracts back down. So all day long it's doing that, and you need a shape-shifting epithelium that we call transitional. Yeah.
They're looking at a slide without knowing that it's a shape-shifting cell. How will we tell the difference between this and the stratified?
Yeah, let's take a look at this. For sure you know this is stratified, I think, by looking at it. If you look at these cells right here, when I look at it, I see pillows. That's how I look at it. I don't really see a cuboidal. I don't see a columnar cell. If I see something that kind of looks like a pillow like that, then that's always going to be a transitional epithelium. And the only one that we talk about in this class is from the urinary bladder. We only look at this particular shaped one. If we go over here, okay, I see columns. If we go back over here, I see cubes. I don't see anything that looks like a pillow, like these kind of oval-shaped things. So pseudostratified doesn't look like this. Oh, you want to go back and take a look at pseudostratified? Ah, look at these right here. Columns. Okay? Yeah, columns. And transitional will never have cilia either. Okay. All right, so those are all epithelia. If we look at this transitional, are there spaces between the cells? You see spaces between the cells? Spaces right here between the cells? No. Okay, so that is an epithelium, nice basement membrane. All right, so that's pretty much it for epithelium, but epithelium can contain these things. All right, I see a bunch of globules of mucus, vesicles, and this is a goblet cell. It is a gland, and it's made up of one cell. And this is the only example of a unicellular gland in your body. Other glands in your body require many cells joined together to make a gland. But this one can function as a gland all by itself. Goblet cell. And this mucus doesn't pick up stains, so it shows up as a really bright part of the slide. All right, let me look here. Glands. Yes, we said epithelium can make glands. I don't think I'm going to spend too much time on this one, but here's the lumen of this particular duct and gland. And if I were to look at, should I zoom in? Maybe zoom. All right. So what kind of epithelium does this look like right here? Simple cuboidal, right? And it can transition into something that looks more like a simple columnar, right, as we get down into the gland. This is what we call a simple tubular gland. This is an exam figure, right? And you don't have to know examples, but this is just a nice straight tube. Here is a branch tube, as opposed to, let me zoom back out, as opposed to this one that looks more like a ball. This ball-shaped structure is what we call an alveolus. So this is a simple alveolar gland. This is a simple tubular gland. You can put a bunch of tubes together to make a branch tube, or you can put a bunch of alveoli together to make a branched alveolar. Right? And then sometimes you can put a bunch of branches together to get a compound tubular or a compound alveolar, which is what we have here. And then some glands, right, will have tubes as well as alveoli. Right? And we call that a tubulo-alveolar type gland. And if you're a pathologist looking at glandular tissue of the breast, glandular tissue of the prostate, looking for breast cancer, prostate cancer, right, then these things would just pop out at you if you look at enough of them. Right? So I would say be familiar with how to classify these from these particular exactly perfect illustrations of what these different glands look like. Okay, so that's it for glands. Oh, okay, two different kinds of glands in your body. I don't have a picture of them, but we'll stay with this one. The two major kinds of glands are exocrine glands and endocrine glands. You might have heard of an endocrine gland before. What can you tell me about an endocrine gland? Maybe that you heard something about an endocrine gland. Where is it located? What does it secrete? What's it good for? An endocrine gland secretes a hormone. Okay? And in order to be a hormone, it doesn't go into a duct. A hormone goes into the blood, and then the blood takes it where in your body? Everywhere, right? So a hormone goes everywhere in your body. That comes from an endocrine gland. So an endocrine gland is a ductless gland. It doesn't need ducts because it has blood vessels to carry its product everywhere in the body. An exocrine gland, on the other hand, has ducts. Right? It doesn't use a blood vessel to carry its product from one area to another. So an exocrine gland secretes something into a duct. The duct carries it to wherever it's supposed to go. Like if it is a sweat gland, where does that sweat end up? On the surface of your body to cool you down. Right? If it's the pancreas, right, it synthesizes digestive enzymes, and those digestive enzymes should get out of the pancreas into your digestive tract where they will work. You don't want those digestive enzymes digesting the pancreas away, right? And that happens. That's really unfortunate, scary when that, deadly when that happens, right? So the pancreas is an example of an exocrine gland. So digestive enzymes go into that duct and it's carried to the digestive tract where they do their job correctly. So all of these glands that we see on the neighboring page, okay, are these endocrine glands or exocrine glands? And why would you say one or the other? Okay. I heard exocrine glands. Who knows why these are exocrine glands? Because here's a duct. Here's a duct. Here's a duct. What's the definition of an exocrine gland? A gland that has a duct. Right? So these are all examples of exocrine glands. And does it say it anywhere on this slide? Probably in your book it says. Okay. All right, so those are the two major kinds of glands, endocrine and exocrine. And then here are the types. So guess what? We're done with epithelium. All right, what can you tell me about the cells in the epithelium in terms of their location? Tightly packed together or far apart? Tightly packed together. Okay. Let's go to the next tissue, the second one of the four that we were looking at. That's connective tissue. Right, connective tissue holds tissues together, it connects tissues, that's pretty much how it got its name. And let's take a look at a connective tissue illustration. Right here. All right, so this is not a picture through a microscope, this is just an artist drawing what a connective tissue looks like. All right, well, I see, it almost looks like a map. Here I see like a street running through there, some side streets, right? Well, these are fibers. All right, so I see fibers in a connective tissue. Okay, and in this area that I'm circling, I see fibers and maybe some other things, but I don't see a cell in this area at all. Can this be an epithelium? There's a part of it that doesn't even have a cell in it. Could that be an epithelium? And your good guess would be no. Right? Let's look at, here's a cell. Right? And here's a cell down over here with a big space between them. So that cannot be an epithelium. This is what we call a connective tissue. And the space between the cells is very important for connective tissue, so we give it a special name. The area between cells is what we call the matrix of a connective tissue. So connective tissues have a matrix where things are put. And what are some of the things? Well, these fibers. And here's a cell secreting a fiber into the matrix. A cell that makes fibers is called a fibroblast. This example of a fiber, really thick one, this is collagen. Where is it labeled collagen? Collagen. It's got to be on here someplace. Collagen. Ah, collagen fiber. Yeah, look at the spelling. Collagen. Collagen is like a steel cable or Kevlar cable. Anybody know what Kevlar is? Anybody? Kind of a new material, really, really strong, just doesn't strike. They can even make cylinders, gas cylinders out of Kevlar. And it's pretty light, but it's super strong. So this collagen fiber doesn't stretch. If you pull it from end to end, it doesn't stretch. That's how strong it is, unless you get into like an airplane accident or a really bad car accident, but they just don't ever get damaged. They're super, super strong. The next kind of fiber I see is a little bit thinner. This one, if you pull it from end to end, does stretch pretty easily, and then when you let go, it goes back to its original length. And I think you could probably tell me what kind of material that you wear does that? Elastic material. So we call this an elastic fiber. These can be damaged. You can overstretch elastic fibers to where it won't go back to its original location, right? But usually it doesn't, right? And then the thinnest fiber I see right here, this is a reticular fiber, and that is very, very, very weak kind of fiber. So in order of strength, from strongest to weakest, what are these fibers? Name the fibers in terms of strength, strongest to weakest.
Collagen.
Collagen? Okay, I like collagen as strongest. What's the next strongest?
Elastic.
I like elastic. And then by far the weakest is reticular. And I say reticular is the weakest because you stretch it a little bit, it just rips apart. At least the elastic fibers will stretch before it rips, and then usually it goes back to its original length. All right, and where do you find these fibers? Inside the cell or in the matrix? In the matrix, right? The extracellular space. And that matrix not only has fibers, but it has another area right here without fibers in it. That's what we call ground substance. Ground substance is like a sponge. It holds water. That's its job. And it's made out of sugar-modified proteins, proteins that have sugar molecules on them, kind of like mucus almost. And a lot of the water is held in this area in our body. So the matrix has ground substance and fibers. Fibers are collagen, elastic, and reticular. And the cells that make these fibers are fibroblasts, right here, in this particular kind of connective tissue. And so this is just an illustration of some kind of general connective tissue. Here's a blood vessel going through it. So connective tissue does have blood vessels. There's probably a nerve going through here someplace, which I don't see. Maybe this thing right here. Connective tissues can have fat cells that store fat for us, and some immune cells as well. All right, well, let's look at some particular examples of connective tissues. Here's one. I see a cell here, and then over here I see another cell. And then way over here I see another cell. Could that be an epithelium? No, cells are far apart. Okay? And here are some fibers, big, strong, thick fibers. What would you call these strong, thick fibers?
Collagen.
And these are elastic, right? Because I know reticular fibers are very branched. They're very gnarly looking. They're very branched. These are kind of more straight. Elastic fibers are more straight than they are bent. So that's how I know this is an elastic fiber. And they're in the matrix. And what's the name of the cell that's secreting these fibers into the matrix? Yeah, fibroblasts. I don't see the whole extent of the cell, but at least I see the nucleus of this particular cell. It's staying really nice and dark like that. So here are fibroblasts. And what is this area of the matrix right here that does not contain a fiber? Ground substance, right. So connective tissue, because the cells are far apart. Now, when I look at this slide, this is a particular kind of tissue called areolar connective tissue. It's not very strong. It has some collagen, but not a lot. And the collagen is oriented in different directions. So it can withstand stretch pretty much in any direction, but not particularly strong in any one direction. That's a characteristic of areolar tissue. When I look at this, it reminds me of a stained glass window. So it'd be good if you could generate some kind of impression in your mind when you look at a slide. What does it remind you of the most? So take a piece of glass, break it up into a bunch of pieces, and put it back together again. I see something that looks like this, right? And in areolar connective tissue, you might have some fat cells, so there might be some yellow cells in here. You might have different colored cells. Again, kind of like a stained glass window. Is stained glass window good for you? Does that kind of remind you of a stained glass window or not at all? A little bit? A little bit? Okay, I hope a little bit. Okay, stained glass window. So that's an areolar connective tissue. Start with this one when you look at it in lab. That's a nice one to find. I'm going to come back to this one. Here is a reticular connective tissue. These are reticular fibers. They stain really dark, but are they long and narrow, or do they have a lot of branches? Yeah, it kind of looks like a root of a tree or something, right? All these branches. So this is a reticular connective tissue. Now, reticular fibers are strong, medium, or weak. By far the weakest, right? And one organ in your body in particular, the framework is reticular connective tissue, that is the spleen. And these reticular tissues are so weak that the spleen is easily traumatized. It can rip apart pretty easily. Any kind of car accident, motorcycle accidents, you get hit really hard in the back with something, somebody punches you, that could rip the spleen, right? And so one way that we can prevent bleeding sometimes is put a suture into something, sew that organ closed like your skin. But these reticular fibers are so weak, as soon as we try to put a suture in, more reticular fibers rip apart. And there's blood vessels. The spleen is highly vascular. So if the spleen is bleeding and you try to sew it closed so it stops bleeding, it rips apart and bleeds more. And you go, oh, well, it's bleeding more. Let's put some more sutures in there. And it rips apart more, bleeds more. That's not helping anybody, right? So when the spleen is damaged, what has to happen is that you have to tie off a blood vessel to the spleen and remove that part of the spleen that is bleeding very carefully, right? If the whole spleen is bleeding, then the whole spleen has to be removed because the kind of tissue it is or the kind of fibers it has is reticular, which is very, very weak. We'll talk some more about the spleen when we get into the immune system. All right, let's look at this one here. Here I see some cells that are secreting these fibers into the matrix. What's the name of a cell that secretes fibers? Fibroblast. Here's the nucleus. I don't see the cytoplasm, but here's the nucleus of a fibroblast. And does anybody recognize these fibers maybe by their color or by their width? Are these thin or kind of thick? Thick. Which fibers were thick ones? Collagen. So here is a tissue that's loaded with collagen molecules, which is what, really strong fibers, and they're all going from left to right in this picture. They're all oriented in the same direction, and they're densely packed together. Collagen is densely packed, not the fibroblast, but the collagen is. So this is what we call dense, regular connective tissue, because collagen is going all in one direction. This is what's used to make tendons and ligaments. If a joint is working properly, for instance, when this biceps pulls properly on the shoulder, on this ligament, just from one end of the, on this tendon, from one end of the tendon to the other, it's almost impossible to damage that tendon. But if you twist your shoulder a certain way, and then you you pull the tendon apart laterally from side to side, then it can rip pretty easily. You can have these long rips, right, or separations within a tendon because that's not the direction that it's really strong in or designed to withstand tension. It's only from what? End to end. Super strong from end to end, not so strong from side to side. Here is a similar kind of tissue. Again, I have fibroblasts. I've got collagen. But now, in this particular case, I have some collagen moving in and out of the plane. That's why it kind of looks more like a tube. Here we have some collagen going from right to left. Here's some that are going up and down. Right, so collagen is oriented in all different kinds of directions. This is what we call dense irregular. And dense irregular can withstand tension in all directions, but not super, super strong in any one direction. And this kind of tissue is made to make up joint capsules, as an example. Right? So a muscle isn't pulling this in a particular direction, but it has to move around depending on how the joint is being used. Dense irregular. That's dense regular. Let's talk about this one. All right. Could you tell, could this be a good example of epithelium? And why? I see something that looks like cells in there, and the cells are far apart. Right? So here's a nice connective tissue. What do we call the space between cells and a connective tissue? Matrix. So yeah, here's a really nice matrix. When I look at the matrix, do you see fibers in there? Do you see fibers? They are not very evident. As a matter of fact, it's probably missing fibers. And when I look at this slide, I see it like a lot of bubbles all over the place, and I see a cell inside that bubble, and these bubbles are just a random arrangement. It kind of looks like a little speckle pattern to me. It doesn't look like stained glass window, right? A little speckle pattern. And this is characteristic of a cartilage connective tissue, and a kind of cartilage that has no fibers is what we call hyaline cartilage. Hyaline cartilage is not very strong because it doesn't have fibers. It covers the ends of bones, right? So it's kind of slippery and smooth. Another name for cartilage is chondro, right? Anytime you hear the word chondro, you should think of cartilage. And whenever you hear the word site, you should think of cell. C-Y-T-E means cell. So a chondrocyte is a cell that is in cartilage. Chondrocyte is in cartilage. So these are chondrocytes. This little bubble is called a lacuna. So chondrocytes are located in lacuna, and they're just special locations, right? And in between them is ground substance. Okay, what time have we got? 12:05. When do we stop? 12:05, exactly. Okay, I got a couple more slides for cartilage, but that's okay because we'll finish this up on Wednesday. The sign-in sheet is up over here, and those of you that got lab, I'll see you upstairs.